Hello, everyone. Welcome to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science means clarity. I'm your host, Manoj Bhupathi, and with me is Ben Barmazi. It must be a Friday because we are recording again. Except today, we're going to try something a little bit different since we just came back from ESMO. Well, Ben came back from ESMO. We don't all have the privilege of going to Berlin.
I can hear your jealousy. I can hear it. It's just reeking through the computer screen. It was a fun conference, though. It was.
Listen, it was an exciting abstracts that were presented there. I'm just following it online. It was remarkable. It seems that way to me, at least.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And I think, you know, I had the privilege of going, a lot of great data, a lot of good conversation with colleagues. And now it's time to break it down, right? And that's why we were there. And we're going to talk about, I think, the top five abstracts. You know, we went back and forth a little bit before we scheduled this recording about which the top five are. So if you have any quibbles with the ordering, if you're listening, feel free to reach out on social media or email us and tell us how you would have ranked them. But we're going to count down our top five, going from 5 to 1. And then we have some honorable mentions that we'll toss in at the end real quick, just so you can kind of get a flavor of some of the other data sets that were presented at the conference. But we really want to focus on the data that's either going to lead to a change in practice, inform our practice, or at least be controversial in this setting of will it or will it not change our practice? These important conversations that you listeners need to know about if you're treating patients out there in the community. So I'm going to go out there and toss out number 5. Are we ready to roll?
I think we're ready, Ben. What's number 5?
Number 5, Capitello 281. So this is a unique study. It's metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, but it's looking at patients with PTEN loss. The way they did the PTEN was by IHC, not by NGS, which I think was probably a miss because it's more complicated, though cheaper if we're talking about a global registrational study, which is probably why it was done. But if we look at previous drug trials in this space, NGS may actually be better than IHC for identifying the patients with the most loss. But that's a side note. This is with capivasertib. That's an AKT inhibitor. And remember, that's very critical in that PI3 kinase P10 AKT pathway. So we're kind of shutting down that signaling pathway that is aberrant in patients with P10 loss, which we know patients with P10 loss can have more aggressive biology in their prostate cancer. So hormone sensitive, P10 loss.
Hey, Ben, can I just ask you a question before you keep going forward on this trial? How often are we actually seeing P10 in this group of patients?
It's actually pretty common. About a third of patients will have some P10 loss, maybe as high as 40%. But if you look at the amount of patients that have a 90% loss threshold, it's about 20%, maybe a little bit less. So it's actually pretty high. So it's a study that's actually worth looking for and understanding this biology. It's rare in the sense that it's a minority of patients, but the denominator of prostate is so large in this country. It's a pretty large subset of patients. Now, they had to screen 5 patients to get every patient on study. So it is a lot of work, right? And a lot of patients kind of didn't make it across the finish line. But this is a triplet versus a doublet. So not with chemo, ADT, abiraterone, capivasertib versus ADT, abiraterone. So a really nice modern control arm. You know, we used to talk about how those triplet studies with chemotherapy were done with probably an improper control arm because the control arm was ADT docetaxel. But alas, this did the right study. Now, it did hit its endpoint. It's a positive study for radiographic progression-free survival extended by about 7 months, 33 versus 25 months. Statistically significant. We don't have overall survival yet. The overall survival kind of looks flat to me. The hazard ratio was 0.9. I know I hate talking about hazard ratios, but it's probably not going to get overall survival. Overall survival is tough in this disease, especially in the hormone-sensitive setting due to all the subsequent therapies. Now, they showed also the more P10 loss you had, you were eligible at 90% loss, but 95 or 99, the more you had, the more different your outcomes were as far as the more significant the impact of the capivasertib had. So I think this was controversial because while capivasertib is not chemo, it's toxic, right? Has a lot of side effects, causes diarrhea, causes taste changes, causes fatigue, can cause cytopenia. So it is a drug that has a lot of side effects, and these patients are going to be on this therapy for a very long time in the hormone-sensitive disease. So it's something that, unlike 6 cycles of chemotherapy, you're talking about being on capivasertib for a really extended period of time. So Manoj, did you see that data? What did you think of that data?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did see this data, and it is interesting to see that the percentage of P10 deficiency is correlating with hazard ratios. But what is a little surprising is that the confidence intervals are getting wider and wider the higher the percentage.
It's so, all patient subsets.
I agree, but you would still expect it to not be the case. The toxicity is certainly something that is going to be key in this group. And so, you know, as you said already, you with chemotherapy, you have a finite number of cycles, and then you're going to be on just ADT, ARPI. Here, you have to manage side effects for a much longer duration of time. So is this not only from a toxicity systemically, but also financial toxicity, something that we got to think about for this group of patients? Now, it would be interesting to see, is Abby the right partner? Or do we really think about Abby, Enza, APA, and Dara all to be equivalent? Do we think that there's some difference mechanistically? Because from a side effect standpoint, we see that there's a huge difference. Now, if this was paired with a different ARPI, can we potentially see better results or worse results? I think those are things that we have to think about as well for this group of patients. And to your point, these patients behave much more aggressively. Right. And if they behave much more aggressively, and if you're not changing their overall survival, as you would expect, because when you added Abby to the ADT, you had a survival benefit. And when you're adding in Capi and not seeing that survival benefit in a more aggressive disease, what are you really driving when you have better therapies potentially down the line?
Yeah, I think these are good points. And it's not guaranteed to get an FDA approval based on the data we saw. There's going to be another cut. OS is immature, right? But I think we can all imagine that it may change. It may change to get better. It may change to get worse. I mean, we just don't know, right? So we'll see another data cut, I'm sure. I don't know that this is enough to get an approval. We'll find out, right? Obviously, they're going to send it to the FDA. So we'll await. But let's go into a future world. Let's say it does get FDA approved. Who knows? What are you going to do? Are you going to give it?
I don't know, because we haven't gone through our entire list and I don't know what I'm going to do.
That's fair. See, I asked him a hard question. I think it's complicated. I think we also know that from data presented at ASCO, PTEN loss patients also do really well with docetaxel. So you're right. You have a cheaper drug, a drug that maybe has a lot of side effects for a 4.5 month period, but is a more brief amount of time. So I don't know either. If you don't give capivasertib now, you're not going to be able to give it in the CRPC setting because those data aren't positive, right? We've seen AKT inhibitors in those space and they're just not positive. So it's your one chance to get an AKT inhibitor. The question is, do you need to get one, right? And I don't think we've answered that. I don't think the data answers that yet. I think we need more time, right? I think we need more time. So I think let's move to four. You want to?
Before we do, I have one question for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, we think about BRCA and we think about PTEN very differently, right? We've talked about PARP inhibition up front after the ASCO data.
Right.
And now we're seeing CAPI data up front. In an ideal world, if you were to have your own design, and I actually don't know the frequency of this, we'd have to go back and look. How often do you see BRCA with PTEN? And I don't know the answer to this. And would you ever think about combining a PARP with a CAPI instead of using ADT now that we're seeing this data? Like kind of randomly.
No, toxicity is going to be bad. It's going to be, I've given these drugs. I don't know. I don't have a big appetite for the side effects that you might see on that study.
I'm just curious. It's just because we're seeing so many of these targeted therapies now. Because we'll talk about another one coming up. But yes, to moving on. So number four is bladder cancer. So this is actually looking at disitamab vedotin plus toripalimab versus chemotherapy in first-line advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma in patients who had HER2-positive expression. So, you know, I asked Ben earlier, how often do we see PTEN in prostate cancer? In bladder cancer, we see HER2 far more commonly. More than one plus is actually more than 70% of all bladder cancer patients. So this is actually a phase 3 study, which was using DV plus T versus chemotherapy in these patients who had higher expression of or expression of HER2, whether it be 1 plus, 2 plus, or 3 plus, but they had to be eligible for platinum-based chemotherapy, and they had to have excellent chemotherapy or excellent performance status. And they were randomized 1-to-1. So patients either got DV plus T or GemCis or Carbo, but a chemotherapy was a maximum of 6 cycles, And the primary endpoint was PFS and the secondary endpoint was OS. And certainly the study did hit its endpoint, right? So DT plus T significantly improved PFS. It was 64% in the DVT versus the chemotherapy arm. It's more than double in terms of months. And then really from a toxicity standpoint, not too much different. And again, the overall survival was also hit. So it was a hazard ratio of 0.54. So it was a 46% reduction. So kind of seeing this data, Ben, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, when you say it out loud, you wonder if that should be number one on the list, right? But I think it loses points because it's coming after enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. So for those of us who are listening to this that don't know what disitamab vedotin is, it's a HER2 antibody drug conjugate. EV is a Nectin-4 antibody drug conjugate, but they both have an MMAE payload. Both, we think there might be some immunogenic synergy with MMAE. They're both performing very similarly. They look very similarly. And the side effect profiles have similar toxicities, except this one doesn't have the skin toxicity in the same way because it doesn't target Nectin-4. And maybe, it looks like maybe less neuropathy, maybe higher amounts of liver enzyme elevations. I don't know. They're not directly compared, right? But we'll have to sort all that out. But you're right. If this gets FDA approved, this is a study that was mostly done, you know, in China. But if this were to get FDA approved right now without having a bunch of US patients on, then you could use either one. They look more similar than different. They're both really similar schedules, great drugs, similar hazard ratios, similar duration of response, similar like doubling of the overall survival compared to chemotherapy. So they're both great, great regimens. And if we think about it, you're right. About 80% of patients have some kind of HER2 expression. Maybe a little bit more than that, have some kind of Nectin-4 expression. Would there be a way in the future to either use AI or some kind of IHC panel or some kind of RNA, something to tell us which one to use? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, one could hypothesize that someone could develop that, someone smarter than the two of us. But, you know, for now, I don't see a reason to switch doing what I'm doing with EVP. But I think that if you had a patient at risk of skin toxicity, then DVT would be an option right there that would be way better than chemotherapy. But if you said you wanted to give DVT instead of EVP, I don't think that would be wrong either. They look the same.
So I don't know. I don't know. I think I would actually check patients for HER2. And if they're positive, just thinking about sequencing, right?
Yeah.
Can you do DVT first and then give EV a second line? Because we don't have much in that era or that space.
Yeah, it's right for the trial exploring EV to DV right now. That's our going. We'll see what that shows because they're both the same payload but different targets. So I don't know. That's not crazy. You could make the same argument the other way around though.
You could. I think one of the challenges with this study though is we haven't done GemCis or GemCarbo alone since like 5 years now.
Right.
And so a lot of patients have received maintenance immunotherapy based on the Javelin data, which showed a survival benefit, right? So how would this have compared if you actually gave immunotherapy as maintenance to that group of patients? The data looks really good, but we know historically now that when you compare GemCis Carbo to immunotherapy maintenance, they do better. We already know that. So I think it's a little, while the data looks really good, I think the comparator arm is not completely fair because we changed practice 5 years ago based on Javelin.
No, it's absolutely not a fair control arm. I mean, EVP also had some issues with similar control arms, right? But it was an earlier study. You're totally right. I just feel like it's going to work really, really well, right? And we know in the neoadjuvant setting, there was an early phase 2 data set that suggests really high CR rates of about 60% with this drug. So it's clearly active. It's a great regimen. It's probably more similar than not to be EV. But I would say if you're listening, you have access, either of these drugs are great. That's how I would phrase it.
I mean, I think the clinical challenge though is how often can we get HER2 testing as a reflex, number one. And specifically in bladder, right? In breast, it's easy because they just do it automatically. But here, we'd have to order that test, wait for that result, and then decide, are you doing EVP versus DVT? And that itself is a delay. And that's number one. And then number two, often these patients are sick and you want to be able to get them started sooner than later. Right. So the easier answer is EVP.
All right, we're moving to three. Good regimen.
What's
complexities? I think three is Rampart. This is the adjuvant renal study. So perioperative renal cell carcinoma has been a conundrum, right? We have the FDA-approved adjuvant year of pembrolizumab with a clearly significant survival advantage that a lot of us are using in clinic now. But we have negative studies with a PD-L1 inhibitor, atezolizumab. We have negative studies with 6 months of Nevo and 6 months of Ipi-Nevo, right? So we just have negative, 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 and one positive. But a lot of us are still getting Pembro because we believe in that data set. I've been giving some Pembro in that space, absolutely. Now, Rampart is looking at three arms. Control arm is, you know, surveillance. Intervention arm that was read out today or last week was durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, with tremelimumab, a CTLA-4 inhibitor. Unlike Ipi-Nivo, you got two doses of tremi, and then you continued out basically like a year of durvalumab. So that was the arm. We don't know the data from the durvalumab alone arm yet. That'll be read most likely next year. So all we have right now is durva-tremi versus surveillance. Similar patient population as the adjuvant pembro, though they did allow non-clear cell. So 15% of patients had non-clear cell, which is important because we don't have anything for those patients right now. And it was a positive study. You had basically a similar difference between the two of about 8% that you saw in pembrolizumab. And that, you know, kind of as the Kaplan-Meier curves come down, about an 8% difference for disease-free survival, very similar to pembro, 81% versus 73% at 3-year DFS. So looks really good. They also did some subsets. And just like we saw subsets of the pembro where the higher risk patients are driving the most benefit, those M1-NED patients, those sarcomatoid patients, here they used a different way to calculate risk that we don't really use in America. Was used on prior studies done, you know, ages ago. But they're showing high-risk patients derive benefit. Intermediate-risk patients don't. So that was interesting. Now, we're not going to be using the scoring system they did. No one in America is going to start using that. But it tells us that there are a lot of those risk nomograms out there. We have a lot of negative studies in the perioperative space. Previously, we actually talked about how we don't use a lot of risk nomograms in our personal practices. We do it every so often. Maybe we need to, because now we have another positive study and it's enriching for patients with higher risk disease. And we can imagine if we really used the same nomograms and ran that across the adjuvant pembro data, maybe it's only the high risk patients that are driving benefit. We don't know that for sure though. So that's something that we'll have to tease out as, you know, more time comes and we see more information from these trials and we see how the durvalumab arm does. But overall, it's nice to see another positive study. It really is. And not, in my sense, not necessarily practice changing, because I don't see the reason that to give necessarily durva-tremi over pembro. We'll see if it leads to an approval. The trial wasn't actually designed to get a label, so we'll see what happens. And we do have increased toxicity from the CTLA-4, but it's practice informing in the sense that, okay, immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting, it makes sense, right? And it's not just a one-off. Manoj is writing something down. He doesn't agree with me. I can tell. I can tell from his face. He doesn't agree with me.
I'm just thinking about this. You know, when I think about Rampart and thinking about the type of patients that were included in this versus thinking about the pembrolizumab data, I don't recall this group having M1 disease as extensively as pembrolizumab. And I may be wrong, but I know they included... Yeah. So I think the percentage of extensive disease or M1 patients was actually higher in the Keynote study compared to Rampart, but I'd have to go back and look at that specific cohort. And the reason I say that is because a lot of the other adjuvant studies that we've looked at, they're all negative because they didn't include M1 patients. And the one other thing here is it the M1 patients that are completely resected that are the true high risk? Do you really need a normogram to figure that out? Or can you ablate or do a metatectomy and then give those patients a single agent therapy, assuming that they don't have any other more aggressive features? That's what I was writing about when you were asked that when
we'll
you were
have speaking. To dig in. So I can tell you off the top of my head, the adjuvant pembro study was like 5.4% M1NED. Could not tell you off the top of my head on Rampart because we just haven't, you know, looked over the same data set 100 times yet, right? So we'll have to update that. But I don't know. I still think the higher risk patients with localized disease are probably, some of them are going to derive benefit. And the question is it the sarcomatoid biology? Is it, you know, poking into a bad T3B, right? Some of these like low risk T3As probably were overtreating. I don't think we fully know. I'm still a believer in giving adjuvant immunotherapy, trying to cure these patients. I think if I could use this in non-clear cell, I want them to show us that data. So we have not seen the non-clear cell data yet, but they're just lumped in this positive study. But if that is positive, I would love to use this in non-clear cell because right now, technically, adjuvant pembro didn't study those patients. So I think this is interesting. I think we're going to see further subsets presented next year. And hopefully they show us the non-clear cell. Hopefully we see what the durvalumab is. That tells us the contribution of the components. And we continue to see, you know, that benefit solidify into a true OS benefit. We'll see.
Yeah, I totally agree with that in that sense. I don't think it's changing anything of what I'm doing either. I still think there's a benefit with adjuvant immunotherapy in these higher risk patients because it's, you know, especially because we've seen the survival benefit already with pembrolizumab. And so it doesn't change anything from that sense. Just thinking about who are these patients, right? That's always the big questions. And that's kind of the thing. So we'll go on to the top two abstracts. And so the number two is what we've been awaiting for a while. It's the PSMA addition study. So this is the phase three trial that was using LU-177 or lutetium combined with ADT plus ARPI in patients who had PSMA positive. Now this is in hormone sensitive prostate cancer patients. And so the experimental arm was using Pluvicto or LU-177 with ADT ARPI, and the control arm was using just ADT plus ARPI. And there was a crossover, which was allowed on this study, and at the time of radiographic progression. And it was a one-to-one randomization with a primary endpoint being RPFS. And the primary endpoint was hit. The other endpoints that was being looked at was the PSMA 90 time to castration resistance and PFS, PFS2 safety data and such. So this is the primary efficacy results that we saw that was presented. And it definitely showed that there is an RPFS benefit between the two arms. And as much as we don't like to talk about hazard ratios, there is an improvement and it's 0.72. The survival endpoint seems like it's trending that way, but it was an interim analysis. So we'll have to see where that goes. But again, the hazard ratio here is also 0.8, but it's not statistically significant. Toxicities were very similar to what we've seen before for any of these drugs. So really, this seems like it's an option, but I don't know. What are you going to do, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, we have to see if it gets an FDA approval based on this data cut. The OS of 0.84, you're right, it's trending in the right direction. We'll see where it ends up. You know, I struggle with this one. We have a good triplet with chemotherapy. Now, we don't know what would happen if we ran that study technically against ADT darolutamide alone, but we have a good triplet with ADT daro docetaxel or ADT abi docetaxel, right? This is a really nice way to not give chemo. And it does look like there's a true statistically significant RPFS benefit. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at the side effect profile, almost half of patients with dry mouth. Some of that's grade one, some of that's grade two. Grade two dry mouth's pretty bad, right? That's not an easy side effect. 15% grade three cytopenias. Again, how many of those are going to be permanent? How many of those are going to recover, right? We need to see the long-term safety. As those who give lutetium understand that sometimes we have longstanding side effects given this radiation. So I kind of wanted to see more on the OS front before I was going to jump and say everyone should get this. I think there are people who should. Absolutely. We got to figure out who they are. Maybe they're higher SUV expression. Maybe they're higher volume of disease at the site of the first dose. They looked at volume of disease. It didn't seem to matter that much. But the challenging thing here is this is not chemo. This is radiation-based therapy, right? So you think about the dosimetry. None of us are radiation oncologists or nuclear medicine scientists, but you actually have to have enough cells to deliver enough radiation to actually have a cytotoxic effect when you're using the beta radioligand like lutetium. So if we're giving hormone therapy for 6 weeks, debulking the heck out of those tumors, and then coming in with 6 cycles of lutetium, by the time we're on cycle 4, 5, 6, even by the time we're on cycle 2 or 3, potentially, what are we potentially treating? We don't know the right number of cycles. I would be guessing that 6 is way more than we need, and we could get less side effects with similar efficacy with less doses in the hormone-sensitive setting. Now, we won't know that information based on this study, right? It would take other studies to know the appropriate amount of dosing in the hormone-sensitive setting. I'm very nervous, though, by the time we're on cycles 4, 5, and 6, that we're causing more side effects and less benefit. Now, we don't know that, but that's my guess. The couple things did pop out. Looks like higher PSA patients have more benefit. So maybe that's a population. Maybe that's a biomarker. Maybe SUV mean is a biomarker, right? We just haven't gotten those data sets presented to us yet. More will come out of this study. I hope they show us all those things so that we can figure out how best to treat these patients. Because for me, when I see this data set, I say, yes, great to have. Hope it gets approved. I'd love to use it in a subset of patients. I want to learn what that subset is. I don't want to use it in every single man with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. That's my take. But I haven't learned who it is yet to give it to.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you said a lot of key things in those last few statements, as well as in the very beginning, where you're talking about the delivery of radiotherapy and how effective is it going to be after you debulk. So one of the more practical questions that I have for you, and I'm curious to know your thoughts, is should we start with Pluvicto up front before you even give ADT or ARPI, trying to get that cytotoxic effect, then add in ADT ARPI as another option, right?
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, right, why not give your like 2 cycles of lutetium, ADT and ARPI for, you know, 6 to 9 months, stop. If the PSA comes back, do it again. You can get up to 6 doses, go again. And, you know, intermittent ADT failed in that era. But in this era where we have other drugs that are very good at playing whack-a-mole with the cytotoxic strategy, I don't know that that wouldn't be a reasonable way to keep men more eugonadal longer, right? So there's a lot of things we can do with this because it is active, right? But how we do it, I just don't think I think a one-size-fits-all strategy is not going to be the best strategy and not how we're treating patients in 2035.
Yeah, and I think that's the key takeaway, right? So one of the key things I think we have to emphasize to our colleagues is the importance of multi-D, or at least a discussion of these patients now. Because earlier we were talking, you asked me, how am I going to treat this patient when we were talking about a P10 patient? I said, I don't know. We haven't gone through our list. And now we're at number 2 and PSMA additions there. And we talked about BRCA alteration patients a while ago, and we mentioned it a little while ago. And then now we're talking about Pluvicto, and we've talked about chemotherapy. So for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, gone are the days where it's ADT-ARPI, everybody gets it. Now it's ADT-ARPI, ADT-ARPI chemo, ADT-ARPI PARP, ADT-ARPI CAPI potentially, or ADT-ARPI plus Pluvicto. I mean, you went from like, or ADT alone. Who's going to get ADT alone?
ARBI, SBRT, and radiation to the prostate for oligometastatic disease. We can't forget about that too. That's another modality that's incredibly important, right? There's a lot.
Right.
A lot.
Right. So now you went from a combination of one drug to an explosion of like 7 potentially options. And so I think the emphasis that I'm trying to make here is that it's not one person that makes this decision. I think you really, really need to figure out with the radiation, with urology, as to who would be the best person or what would be the best therapy for the right patient based on all these options that we have in this era of new data that's coming out with a lot of these targeted therapies.
I agree. And I think once the dust settles and we get a little bit more data sets, we got to get a urology friend on and a radiation oncology friend on and have a conversation about all these therapies. from a multi-D standpoint, could kind of encourage our colleagues about how would we treat these patients in our own multi-D settings and how they should be thinking about it. So I think it's really good, but we'll see more and we'll talk more and we'll see what the FDA does. Okay.
You want to go to our number one abstract?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I chose to start number five. That way I could do number one because, you know, I wanted to do what I said was the best abstract. So this is EV-303 or KEYNOTE-905. This is the neoadjuvant perioperative EV Pembro study that we've all been waiting for. So for those of you listening, there's two studies. There's the cis-ineligible study. That's this study. The cis-eligible one will probably read out next year, we all assume. So it's a separate study. So we're focusing on cis-ineligible or platinum-refusal patients. So 20% of patients refused platinum. That's how they got in the study. They got three cycles of neoadjuvant EV Pembro, enfortumab vedotin Pembro, in the neoadjuvant setting. And then they got six cycles of adjuvant enfortumab vedotin and also continued on pembrolizumab for up to a year. So that was that study, right? Very clean perioperative study. Control arm is basically nothing but cystectomy, right? Because, you know, we don't give neoadjuvant carbo. These patients are cis-ineligible. So it's a very clean study. We've been waiting for it, and it's as good as we were hoping. Event-free survival not reached versus 15.7 months. The landmarks, though, we can discuss. 24-month landmark, 74.7% versus 39.4%. I mean, that's like blowing it out of the water. The pathologic CR rate is above 50%, the highest we've ever seen on a phase 3 study. So you got hazard ratios for event-free survival, 0.4. You got overall survival with hazard ratios of 0.5. It just looks really good. And it's not, it's if for comparison, Niagara, which is the biggest thing before this, GemCis Durvalumab in cis eligible patients has a path CR rate of 37%, right? So now we have a path CR rate of almost 20 percentage points higher than that on this study in a cis ineligible patient population, and in theory should be a sicker patient population, though, you know, you can't really know until you get these patients on the study. So in my opinion, this is a paradigm shift. This is the new standard of care. Let's get the label. It's under expedited review, and let's start giving this to patients yesterday.
A couple questions for you.
Manoj the skeptic. All right, go ahead.
No, so I guess I'm learning here, and I want to understand what you're going to do because I'm a little not sure. And what I'm going to ask you is surgery. Who needs it?
Yeah, great question.
Because 10% of these patients didn't get surgery. And if we have drugs where we can make the malignancy go away and we don't have to do anything else, then why do we need surgery?
I drew out a trial design on a piece of scrap paper while I was in Berlin, okay, at ESMO. We got to figure this out because I think EVP, and we need to decide how many neoadjuvant cycles you need, right? Because actually the CIST study is four neoadjuvant cycles instead of three, just to complicate the heck out of our future use of these drugs. But we'll break that down. We'll decode that when it's time. But, you know, I agree. I think if you have a remarkable response with EV and Pembro, and you did 3 to 4 cycles of that, and then you did a cystoscopy and you didn't see anything in the bladder, and you did ctDNA and it was negative, and you did a PET scan or CT scans and didn't see any metastatic disease or any kind of spread of disease, how many of those patients could we either, one, provide radiation to, or two, maybe even nothing, and then radiate or intervene at the first evidence of recurrence, whether it's in the urine DNA, the blood DNA, or a cystoscopy? So I don't think we know the answer to that, but I think it's time to start exploring it.
Yeah, I mean, you extrapolate from metastatic, right? We have a lot of patients, and yeah, I'm sure you do too, and I've certainly seen this. It's now that EVP has been used in first-line bladder cancer, where they've hit CR within 6 months, some within 3 months, and they've had a complete remission, and they're off therapy now, and there's no evidence of malignancy that's come back, and this is metastatic, like widely metastatic disease. So now you're talking about a group of patients who have localized disease, and you are giving them this combination with the rate, the response rates that you're telling them, then that would be something really to think about. The other concern that I don't know what I'm going to do about is neuropathy. Now, this group of patients who are cis-ineligible, they're usually cis-ineligible, and neuropathy is one of those criterias. So this is a drug that causes significant neuropathy. Now, do you omit the adjuvant part with EV when you have this group of patients? Do you use ctDNA to follow them? We have data that shows that you can use ctDNA to kind of help guide therapy, but you also have data that even if you have negative ctDNA, you should still consider adjuvant therapy.
Yes, that's complicated. And I'm going to bite. Okay. I got you because you know me, I like to hear the sound of my voice. So you have a data set with adjuvant atezolizumab, IMvigor010. Positive ctDNA, benefit to the PD-L1 therapy in the adjuvant setting. Negative ctDNA, no benefit, trend towards harm. At ESMO, which we're not going to discuss today, CheckMate 274, ctDNA analysis. That's the adjuvant nivolumab analysis. Positive ctDNA, benefit. Negative ctDNA, no difference, right? Retrospective, trial design, not blah, 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 caveats out. Okay, but that's two studies. So my guess is the Niagara subset, which is what you're discussing, that's the CisGem-Durva data set that says if you're ctDNA negative, you still got a benefit from immunotherapy. My guess is that that benefit is being manifested in the neoadjuvant portion of that program. Now, we don't know that. And I will be, remember, I've had to come on this podcast and eat crow because I was wrong before. So I could be wrong here again. What I would say is you probably have to give it the way the trial was conducted for now. Perioperative, neoadjuvant, EVP, and adjuvant EVP. However, if you got a ctDNA negative result and a path CR by after giving the neoadjuvant three cycles, and they have neuropathy, I'm dropping the EV. If they don't have neuropathy, I'm continuing the EV, right? And that's how I'm going to do it until they develop neuropathy, because that neuropathy could be forever, right? They may be cured of their disease, live for another 20 years with neuropathy, right? So this isn't the metastatic patient where you want to, you know, push them to give them the best chance of survival. This is, we might cure some of these patients without anything, right? Some of these patients can be cured of surgery alone. So we need to remember that. That's how I'm going to do it. But I'll be very liberal about taking that EV off in the adjuvant setting if I had negative ctDNA and feel good about it.
So I'm going to ask you a more provocative question, I think. Okay. And that is this, which is, you know, earlier, this is a group of patients where this is specifically those presented for cis ineligible.
Yeah.
And you made a comment that you're going to use this. Now, Niagara is cis eligible.
Right.
So technically different patient population. Right.
Right.
So are you now going to make everybody cis ineligible so you can use EVP?
Well, the study said platinum refusal, so we'll see what the FDA label says, okay? I don't know. 20% were on for platinum approval. Look, I think EVP is probably a better regimen than CisGem-Durva. We're never going to get that study head-to-head. Even the cis-eligible is not going to have durvalumab, right? So we're never going to have that study. But technically, if it's not on the label, I can't recommend it. That being said, if I was a patient, and I was treating myself, I would give myself EVP even if I was cis eligible. Do I know for sure that that's correct? No. And if that trial reads out negative, which it may next year, you're going to have to reverse course. But we have the responsibility of men and women trusting their lives with the decisions we make, right? And we got to do the best we can. And I think right now, the best we can, if I had to guess, is going to be EVP in all of these settings. Now, we'll see what the label says, right? Because we'll only get reimbursement based on the label and NCCN guidelines. But I personally believe that that is the correct way to probably treat patients in the vast majority of settings. Bad psoriasis, you know, brittle diabetic. You know, there's a lot of reasons potentially to give CisGem-Durva over EVP in the neoadjuvant setting. There's probably more reasons in the neoadjuvant setting than the metastatic setting. But let's see what the label says, and then we can debate those reasons, right? But for me, that's...
Let me ask you your opinion on this. You know, we previously said that chemo's dead in first-line metastatic bladder cancer. So yeah. If you had to extrapolate that, would you say that chemo's dead in neoadjuvant bladder cancer there?
I think it's dying. It's not technically dead yet, but it's withering.
Dying.
Yeah, it's a bad vintage of wine. And eventually we may not make any more wine from that vineyard. You know, I mean, chemo's back front line, though. Let's go. If you've heard best on UDP, chemo's back in an ugly way for now. But yeah, I think we'll see. Let's see what the label says. But if the label is platinum ineligible or platinum refusal, I do think the majority of my patients are going to get EVP. I assume you're going to be the same way.
Yeah, I'm going to do the same thing. It's really no difference. I think the question really becomes how soon can I drop the EV is really the big question to ask. And, you know, we've seen monotherapy with pembrolizumab and perioperative space. Response rates were not that great. So clearly the EV is adding a lot to make this successful, right? The PURO1 study was what looked at perioperative pembrolizumab. I mean, that was something that was being utilized more for those unfit patients that couldn't really get chemo, but wanted to do something. And so this is a game changer for sure. Yeah. So that was our top five. Hopefully this will be more yet to come on details and how we're going to implement this into practice. So some honorable mentions that I think we felt that were important to talk about. So first one was the lutetium versus docetaxel study. What were your thoughts on this, Ben?
I mean, that's interesting. Phase 2 study, randomized Canadian group, multi-center Canadian trial. They looked at basically your CRPC, you're progressing on an ARPI and ADT, right? And now your options are docetaxel and lutetium, right? Those are our options in America as well. Forget, you know, the PARP inhibitors. That's not relevant to this conversation. So you could go docetaxel to lutetium or lutetium to docetaxel. And the RPFS is slightly greater for chemo, not statistically significant, 10.7 versus 8.6. The hypothesis actually from the group, I think, was that Pluvicto was going to be better, but it's not. And then if you looked at the overall survival, it's actually favoring docetaxel, 18.2 versus 14.3 months with a statistically significant p-value there. So chemo actually beat lutetium in this phase 2 study. Now, it's not a phase 3 study, but it beat lutetium by about 4 months on overall survival. And then they looked at the SUV, mean SUV, which we think would be a biomarker of who would do better. And we saw that in lutetium versus cabazitaxel, but post-docetaxel. That's a separate patient population. This is chemo naive. Those with high versus low, it didn't affect as a predictive biomarker of what to give lutetium or chemo. It was prognostic, better SUV, higher SUV, better outcomes on both drugs, right? But it did not say that you should start with lutetium versus docetaxel based on the SUV. So for me, this is interesting that docetaxel actually beat lutetium for the average man. Tail of the curves are going to be different, right? But interesting.
I agree.
Yeah. So I don't know that this is practice changing. This is just practice informing, right? Chemo has a very strong role in prostate cancer still. All right. The next one was Keymaker U03. And this was a big study. We're not going to break this whole thing down because it is a large study. They had 5 arms in the front line, clear cell kidney cancer, LAG-3 plus Pembro, Lenvatinib, TIGIT plus Pembro and Belzutifan, anti-CTLA-4 plus Pembro, Lenvatinib, Belzutifan plus Pembro, Lenvatinib, and then control of like Pembro, Lenvatinib, though it's not technically control. It's not a phase 3 study. It's kind of just a reference control. And that's a lot of arms. And actually, there might have been signals of lower response with the TIGIT and the LAG arms. I think those modalities keep failing in kidney cancer. It may be time that we move on from those modalities in kidney cancer. CTLA-4 looked okay, but it didn't look better when you had that triplet versus pembrolizumab, CTLA-4 plus pembrolizumab. But belzutifan pembrolizumab looked really good. Response rate was about the same, a few points lower than pembrolizumab, but the duration of response was tremendously in, you know, 31.8 month median PFS, duration of response 33 months, just kind of beating pembrolizumab by about 8-9 months. So that looks good. It's not practice changing yet, but we do have a phase 3 study in this space looking exactly at PD-1, CTLA-4, lenvatinib, and lenvatinib, belzutifan, PD-1 versus pembrolizumab. So we're going to answer this question definitively. And now, based on this data set, I'm going to guess that it's going to be a positive study for lenvatinib, belzutifan, pembrolizumab. I think it's too soon to start using this in practice. I'm not recommending that. I'm not personally going to start using it. But it is exciting to see that we might be finally moving the needle in frontline kidney cancer for very fit patients.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this requires a lot more discussion in terms of the number of arms and things like that. So I totally agree. I think the last one that I would say is the Len-Cabo study. Really interesting to see the comparison of Lena versus Cabozantinib. We've never seen that. Now, how, you know, it does suggest that using Lenev in a more fit patient may be better compared to using Cabo. I guess it's not entirely surprising. Just you using dual mechanism of action compared to a single agent drug. The toxicity certainly is going to be the big issue with that combination of therapy. I don't think I have anything else to say about that.
No, I think that's fair. I think you can use Lenev in the second line if your patient's number one goal is progression-free survival in the second line. But, you know, that line, we're also talking about, you know, how are you going to live? What's your quality of life? So I think it's complicated, but I think they're both active drugs. And I think you could use, I mean, they're both active regimens, and I think you could use either, depending on the goals of your patient. Yeah. So good. I think that's that. You know, there was some non-muscle invasive disease with BCG and immunotherapy that we're going to avoid because we're not urologists. So I think, you know, ESMO was great. A lot of data, some practice-changing data, absolutely. Some practice-informing data. And of course, you know, Manoj, tell them where to find us.
Yeah, follow us on X at Oncology Decoded, or you can email us at podcast@oncologydecoded.com. Thank you for your support, and we look forward to joining you soon again.
All right. Thank you.